Welcome back to Trickle Down Socialism, where we discuss how the U.S. currently has a system of socialism for the super rich and corporations, where we try to defang the term socialism and explore how government, with just a slight tweak in priorities and a focus on social investment, could be a force for good in all of our lives.
Welcome back to Trickle Down Socialism, listeners. I'm hearing that Dan might have been located somewhere in those woods of New Hampshire. How's it going, Dan?
Yeah, so I was confused because I was in these White Mountains, which are green, by the way. So I don't know what's going on with that. And then I got into the Green Mountains, which are also green. And I was like, I was starting to think that boundaries are artificial. Like, I was like, isn't this kind of like the same place?
The big yellow line, like in Looney Tunes.
I saw a sign that said all cows matter. I wasn't sure what that meant. I was not having it though.
So on this episode, I'm going to be interviewing William Compton, who is a music teacher in Kentucky, who's running for Kentucky's first district. Other big news for the pod is that I recently finished reading a book called Evil Genius by Kurt Anderson. He's been an NPR host and written a number of novels as well as nonfiction books. And I just kept tweeting about specific things in the book that I found fascinating. And he ended up following me and he's coming on the pod. I'll be interviewing him later this week. So Kurt Anderson wrote Evil Geniuses about how since Reagan, our system has been rigged so much that inequality is at an all-time high and that basically big business interests have been able to control lawmakers to the point where they've basically had their will with American laws.
That's dope, Pat. Nice work. There's a lot of cool stuff going on in Kentucky. You guys know Charles Booker?
Yes, of course.
So now he's taking on Rand Paul, which sounds like an awesome fight. And like, who, even if you're like a hardcore conservative, like who actually likes Rand Paul? I mean, really, you know what I mean?
No, we know his neighbor does not like him.
Yeah, he's very smug. He's just so smug. You know, he'd be like, well, listen, you know, like when he starts talking, you're like, I'm going to be lectured to right now. Like you know that that's coming.
Right. And I really love the fact that he's running for office and so prominently highlighting the fact that he worked at McDonald's for so long. Like it's very prominently featured on his campaign website. And that's just smart. You know, like there's so many people who either have that job or have that as a side job. And he's so much more relatable because of that.
Yeah, I worked at, when I graduated high school, I was too young to get a real job. I graduated early. So I had to get a job at Burger King just for the summer between high school and college. And it was the lowest paying job I've ever had. And also like the most grueling, laborious job I've had. It's tough work and it's thankless work.
Yeah. And the managerial, especially his part about that sounded really tough because like you got to be the, you know, you do a lot of communicating for corporate. You've also got to look out for your folks, you know, and it sounds like it's beastly in the summer down there in those kitchens. Whew.
Yeah, I supervised at a Starbucks for a long time as well and did that function of going between management and employees for a corporation that really didn't give a shit about either. An awful experience. You know, looking up kind of the history of his district, it swings super heavy Republican. It swings like 22 Republican. And the dude who's been there has been in that seat since like 2009.
Guthrie. Yeah, Brett Guthrie.
Yeah.
Unless we're talking about like low income folks, I'm not for like upper middle class liberals who went to Swarthmore getting any sort of relief. I think that's a waste of money. I mean, if we're talking about poor folk, then of course it's just a government program, but relieving all of the 22-year-olds who chose to go to BU, I don't know.
Yeah, so I do want to focus on the fact that Biden seems to only be doing very little student debt relief when it was a big part of the Democrats' platform. And I mean, for me, it's all about universality, right? And versus means testing, which costs money on its own to even do the means testing. And just think that the number of people of color with student loan debt that's crippling is like proportionally just super high when you look in certain age categories. And I originally went with something like what you were saying, Dan, and I actually listened to somebody who told me that it would drive a wedge between, you know, the educated quote unquote elite and, you know, other people with other types of debt. But I think for me, what it would do is it would set a precedent saying like from time to time, the government will take a look at debt and say, this is onerous and this needs to be mitigated in some way. So as opposed to saying like, oh, with a debt, you're totally on your own, because it's not a new concept. The idea of debt jubilees have happened since feudal days, and they happened in the British Empire. Having a conversation, I think, and showing people the economic boon that would come out of raising that debt for so many young professionals would show that government stimulus in the form of debt relief is a positive.
Yeah, I'm not anti. I also think if we back up, college cost inflation is about 8% a year since the 80s. And most other items, it's like 3%. Why is that? Because the federal government is guaranteeing, essentially, as long as you have decent credit, any amount of money through a PLUS loan, right, at a super high oppressive rate. So they're getting people to sign up for shit that, frankly, they can't afford. It's not altogether different than like a housing bubble. We have like an education bubble where people are taking out debts that they shouldn't be taking out. And if we wipe it away, now you're in a situation where the colleges just get away scot-free. There's no downward pressure on that.
Well, I do think the downward pressure comes from creating an entirely free public college and university system.
I'm down for that. But if we're subsidizing people's liberal arts degrees, I feel like that plays right into their, you know, let's build some more new dorms in a conference center.
I mean, and another reason I don't agree with that take is that right now, for most professions, an undergrad degree is like a high school degree used to be, right? So it's not, I don't think we're in a place where we can call it optional or even frivolous, right? Even if it's a liberal arts degree, even if it's a degree in whatever you want to pick, some random thing, completing 4 years of college is sometimes the very baseline for a lot of entry-level positions in a lot of industries. So once it becomes something like that, then now you've got, in my view, the government has a responsibility to make sure that everyone can attain that. And so for people who are saddled with student loan debt, that should be wiped out, in my opinion. And then going forward, I think we should definitely put pressure on the federal government to provide enough support so that public colleges and universities could be free.
Where do you stand on debt relief, C-Money?
For me, I'm all for it. And I'm for the debt jubilee type relief, like cleaning the slate. I just think that's why you see so many of these like quality of life issues being talked about, like the millennial generation having less quality of life than their parents. I mean, nobody can afford houses now. You know, there's a housing crunch. We're kind of lacking housing for homeless people, but even for people who could potentially afford homes if they weren't
people with jobs.
Yeah, yeah. And I just, I'm all for it. I don't think what Joe has done or has been with doing is student debt relief. You know, it's like 0.1% of the $1.7 trillion owed.
I mean, here's what kind of did it for me is the fact that when I was wishy-washy on it and thinking that, you know, maybe medical debt, maybe other things should be prioritized, then I saw that Black Americans hold on average twice as much student loan debt as white Americans. So like it does actually feel like it's doing some real good and creating more equality. As opposed to, and I do hear your concern, Dan, that this is just going to give carte blanche to liberal arts schools. But I think if you had a Senate that was willing to do away with the filibuster, you could start making rules such as, you know, you can't increase the tuition more than X amount year over year, things like that to try to control costs on the private side. But I do think the very best measure that we could put in place is free public and state colleges just across the board. Representative Presley, Ayanna Presley, who I've had the privilege of seeing speak to a group of students at Brighton High. And let me tell you, kids who usually have their phone out had their phones under their leg. They were just rapt listening to every word that Representative Presley shared. But she just put it really simply, you can't be anti-racist if you're anti-student debt collection. So she's like really putting it in more absolutist terms there. But yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot that needs to be done because you make a really good point, Dan, that if you do just wipe this debt, you're going to have colleges feel emboldened to charge more. That's where I get back into the headspace of thinking about the generation that's just aging into voting now and maybe will do so in the next 4 years or so. I just feel like they are more aware of what the world is like. And so they know that people actually get paid to go to college in Scandinavian countries or have no student loan debt after going to school in Spain or in the UK. So I just think that like the electorate's going to start saying this is unacceptable, I hope.
Let's get some TikTokers on the pod.
I know. We need to get, I've got a few now that are following me on Twitter and been, you know, getting some likes from the Markieverse. So we'll see how that plays out.
See, buddy, you want to do a TikTok with me?
The other piece of Compton's interview that I thought was interesting is C-Money mentions the fact that that district, the Kentucky's first congressional district, swings hard right. And that, you know, it looks like it's a pretty uphill battle for William Compton. Now, I think just the value in just being openly gay and running for office is can't be overstated, right? So like, you know, he mentions in the interview, kids have already come up to him or people, you know, adults and said your bravery is amazing. I can't believe you're open about your sexuality and you're running for such a public position. So there's value in just his campaign. I think will bring a lot of, you know, normalization to people who never really think about it or aren't open to thinking about it, but also for any kids who are, you know, questioning their sexuality or are they know that they're not straight, they're not cis, but they are scared to come out. You know, I think his presence on the campaign trail will have a huge impact there. Our guest on this episode is William Compton. He's running for Congress in Kentucky's 2nd District. He is a music teacher at the high school, middle school, and elementary school level, teaches music. Welcome to Trickle Down Socialism, Mr. Compton. We're excited to have you on the show.
Excited to be here.
So one thing I wanted to clarify there, do you teach all those levels of music?
I do. My day is pretty full. I start at my high school and then I jump over to one of our four elementary schools on my side of town, depending on which day of the week it is. And then I end the day at the middle school. I teach the most classes there with three classes split between seventh and eighth grade.
Wow. That's a busy day as a fellow teacher. That sounds little bit anxiety provoking to me. So could you go ahead and give your introduction to our listeners? So like, you know, who are you and why did you decide to run for Congress?
Certainly. My name is William Dakota Compton. I'm a 27-year-old orchestra director from Bowling Green, Kentucky. I've lived here my whole life. I am also the youngest member on my local city commission of Plum Springs, which is just outside of Bowling Green. It's a really small city. And I'm also the first member of the LGBTQIA+ on this commission as well. I have been teaching orchestra for 5 full years. My 6th is starting this fall. And it's really kind of starting in about 2 weeks because I help out with marching band. So we have band camp coming up. And I graduated from our local University of Western Kentucky back in 2016 and again went back to my alma mater, which is where I am teaching now. So it's a pretty cool full circle loop of where I ended up right now.
That does sound like a great full circle loop. How long have you been on the city council?
I actually was just elected back in November as a write-in candidate.
Okay, great. And one thing I always ask when I have a candidate on the show is, are you committed to being a grassroots candidate, meaning not accepting big money donations, dark money, that type of thing?
Oh, most definitely. We are seeing too many politicians who are being persuaded by corporate PACs and lobbyists, and they're getting money left and right from them for their campaigns. And seeing this happen and doing research about it, it's been very disheartening. So I really am trying to be that candidate that will not take money from those type of people, and really just be that grassroots candidate that for the people.
Great. So why would Medicare for All or some type of single payer healthcare make a difference for the people of the district that you're trying to represent?
Well, as many people in the country are aware, Kentucky is one of the poorest states in America. And actually, back in April, it was ranked 47th out of 50. Because of this, many Kentuckians do not have the ability to pay for healthcare, which means they don't have the proper access to it. And when an emergency comes forward, there are a lot of people in our state who will either get really stressed because they had to go to the hospital for something major, or will even just say, forget it, I'm fine, and risk their life about it just simply because they cannot pay for it. Medicare for All system would help with that. It would give everyone in our state the chance to go to the doctor when they have a pain that they've never felt before, would give them a chance to live a better life and even a longer life, and not have to worry about that financial burden of having health care.
Sounds like a really complete answer on that. So it's about access to care and, you know, kind of getting folks in the door to see their doctors on a more regular basis so that they're not relying on the system in times of emergency. Is that like one of the biggest stressors you feel like for families in Kentucky?
Oh, yes, especially when it comes to healthcare. A little personal story, if you don't mind. About a month ago, I was doing yard work, and I somehow got into poison ivy in my yard, and I'm super allergic to it. I had to go to the emergency room because my eyes were swollen shut, and I was having a hard time breathing, and all of those things that accompany it. I was in there for about an hour. I got a steroid shot. I got my bill back last week. It was $1,332 for a steroid shot just for poison ivy.
Oh, wow.
And if you think about the average worker and even the people who are struggling just to make ends meet now, if they got a bill for over $1,300, that would put a stressor on people, and it's not right. It needs to be fixed, and Medicare for All would help fix that.
Absolutely. Okay, so another thing that I found striking and kind of exciting about doing my research for this interview was when I looked over your campaign website, I noticed that you had two paragraphs written that were really well written, but you prominently featured the fact that you worked at McDonald's. Now, I don't say that kind of to call you out. I say that for the fact that I feel like it'll make you feel much more accessible to so many people across the country, but potentially in your district. What did you learn while you were working at McDonald's that you think will stay with you when you get to Congress?
The biggest thing I learned was working at McDonald's is not as easy as what people think it is. The fast-paced environment, not only mentally is it stressful, and then you have to change orders really quickly when something happens, and then the dangers of being in the kitchen next to the hot grill or the fry oil that they use and everything. It's not easy. And then add in the fact of during the summer times, there's the chance that the air conditioning may go out, and it can be over 100, 110 degrees just in the kitchen area. And I've worked in times like that, and it's stressful. When I finally left McDonald's as a manager, there were times where I was pretty much doing the work of four or five people on each shift. And it would take a toll out of me. Knowing that, when I go to Congress, I will fight to ensure that those people at least have a living wage, because they're doing hard work, whether it looks like it or not. They're working really hard in those restaurants and in any fast food restaurant. They work really hard. And that's one big thing. They at least deserve to get paid for how they're working.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I think there's dignity to all work, right? So an hour of anybody's time, you know, needs to be a living wage in my estimation. Do you think that a push for more unions would help fix some of those working conditions and also help with the negotiating a much more livable wage?
Most definitely. If you look, and you said you were a history teacher, if you look back, most of the time unions have helped us obtain what we have now. And by creating more unions and by expanding the unions we have, we can get even more to help our workers in America, which they've just kind of been left out in the dust for quite a while. And I think having those unions would help.
So another issue that I've seen you tweet about, I've seen on your website as well, is the issue of student loan debt and where folks sit with that, and just the possibility of canceling student loan debt, either a portion of it or all of it, all the federally held debt. How would that make a difference for people in the second congressional district of Kentucky?
So growing up is the millennial that I am. I took the advice from everyone who mentored me through school of, if you go to college and you get a good career, you'll have a good job, stable job, you'll have the financial stability that everyone wants. No one mentioned it if you weren't in a rich family. And so myself and a lot of my peers growing up, we did that. We graduated. We have respectable jobs all across the spectrum. And we're still left with a large amount of student loans that we're struggling to pay right now. And seeing some of these student loans that are taking longer to pay than some 30-year mortgages on houses just because of interest rates, it is, again, an added stressor onto a lot of people's lives. And then you add on the fact that up until about 2 years ago, many educators in Kentucky, they had to get a master's degree in order to teach longer than 10 years. You have those group of people who have that added debt along with their family lives and whatever else they have accumulated during their first 10 years of teaching. And by canceling all of that, we free up all of this for everybody to where they can put that money back into the economy. They can pay off any debt that they have in other aspects like car debt or even their mortgages. And younger people, when they first get out of college, they have already graduated college, and are renting places. If you cancel their student debt, then they have a higher chance of actually buying their own home instead of just having to rent all the time. And so it frees up a lot of possibilities for the people in my district. And it would just help everyone out, have everyone have that more stable life that would be helpful to us all, if that makes any sense.
No, that makes a lot of sense. I think one of the points that's undersold about canceling student loan debt is how much more young people would enter into things like a home mortgage. You know, there's constant talk of why aren't young people buying houses? Well, they can't because they're paying off their student loan debt right now. And, you know, you make a great point about teachers. There are some incentives, like I teach in a school where, you know, you can have some student loan debt deferment and stuff like that. But it's still, teachers are feeling that. They're feeling the pinch of paying off their student loan debts and teaching, which, as you and I both know, is a more than a full-time job. Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. So this leads right into my next question, which is that I'm so excited about the fact that you have experience as a teacher in public education and you're running for Congress. You know, we had a little talk a little bit on Twitter before this interview about the fact that, you know, I feel we need more teachers in Congress because of how well they multitask and how they, you know, think about others' perspectives quite a bit. But what do we need to do to start addressing the gaps that we have? So that's like racial achievement gaps, poverty gaps, et cetera. Where do we start with that issue?
Well, first of all, the best place to start is to have people who have been in the teaching field making policies about teaching. They know what's going on. They know how to handle it. They've been in the trenches. And they need to make those choices, or at least have them consult the choices and use them as expertise. As far as policies and everything, we need to fund our schools and in every part of our nation. There are schools in my district and across the state that are still using textbooks that are 20 or 30 years old. When the pandemic hit, we saw many schools who had issues with giving technology to students so they could still continue to learn during the distance learning phases. And a majority of those schools with the lack of funding tend to be the ones who have the larger minorities in their schools and the larger group of people who are at the lower socioeconomic status. And so by addressing that need, I think that would help the gaps a little bit. And there's a whole slew of things we could do to help. We could also end high stakes testing and having that tied to school funding as well, which is another big stressor with that, because I know teachers in my school district, because our state testing, except for this year, has in the past been tied to funding. They've just been on the go left and right with the curriculum. And sometimes it takes kids longer to understand material. And having that differentiation is important with students. And because of the stress, teachers are just so focused on, I need to get through this content, that sometimes they may be forced to leave kids behind who could help. And again, they typically are the ones who have the low socioeconomic status or the minorities. And so ending that high stakes testing would give the teachers the chance to reach every student in their classroom and not have to worry about, well, am I meeting this content? I need to be here by this date at this time, and we need to be learning about, and they can go back and reteach those kids, because kids are going to forget and they're going to need to be retaught anyway. And so those are some of the things we could do. Again, there's a whole slew of things we could to help fix those gaps. But in the education field, I feel like those are kind of the big ones we could do.
No, and I think your answer is perfect in that you start with, we need teachers making the decisions. It doesn't, you know, that's not a radical idea, but unfortunately, I feel like all too often those decisions are made by people who have not done any teaching. You know, you look at Betsy DeVos, that's just a great example of someone who never even really set foot in a public school, who's in charge of education across the country. Now, the differentiation piece I thought was a great point. So I just want to make sure that our listeners are clear here. You're explaining something that I feel as a teacher. Now, I'm a little bit free from it because I teach history and we don't have a state standardized test for history yet. But your point is that because of the fact that we have tests that are so high stakes that funding is tied to them, we have, you know, particularly our math and English teachers feel as if they need to just get through all the content that the kids are going to see on the test. And they don't have the luxury of going back and reviewing things that the teacher might recognize as fundamental, really important material, because of the fact that they need to make sure that every kid that could possibly do as well on the test is going to do as well as they can because of the consequences that are tied to those tests. That's the point that you're trying to make with that?
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah, it is definitely something that we, you know, teachers that I've taught with we're always talking about it. You know, how about some more time that we can spend teaching the kids and less time testing, I think is the best way I've heard it phrased. Okay, so the next question has to do with early childhood education, which I recognize you are, you know, kind of across levels, but early childhood education is not, you know, what you've done with your career. But I just found it interesting that my mother-in-law works for a company that designs early childhood screening tests. So basically ways to identify where the needs are as kids enter school. And so because of the fact that she sees data across the country, you know, and state by state, she noticed that Kentucky and a number of other states in your region kind of just hit her as just extremely low in terms of readiness. So readiness for school is not an academic measure so much as it is a measure of like just the things that a kid can do as they enter kindergarten, right? And so I was wondering if you could reflect on, you know, kind of what you know about early childhood education in Kentucky and kind of where it is now versus like where you'd like to see it. Do you know anyone who teaches preschool, or could you have reflections of like some of the kindergartners, first graders, second graders that you see and where they are in terms of readiness for the academic setting?
Yeah, in Kentucky, I haven't heard a lot about universal pre-K. We fortunately do have one of our state representatives who in 2019, she was fighting for it up in Jefferson County, which is one of the bigger counties in our district or in our state. But other than that, you only really hear about preschool programs in our state, and in which I went through a preschool program growing up, and my school district has a preschool program, and the teachers in these preschool programs, they're just amazing. They work their tail end off, and they try their best. But the students only go to these preschool programs twice a week. They're in my county, they're alternating days. And of course, during the pandemic, it was only one day a week. So those kids were even farther behind. And for a large majority of the kids in these programs, because they are not getting a lot of extra help at home on the days they're not there, the preschool program tends to be more of almost like a babysitting service for a lot of kids instead of something to help them with getting ready for kindergarten. And again, these teachers, they're trying, and all of them are trying to get them ready for kindergarten, but it's so hard just seeing them twice a week and not having any help outside of the classroom. And so I would like to see Kentucky implement a stronger universal pre-K or pre-education program to where kids can be there longer and can have that support, because a lot of kindergartners and first graders do come into kindergarten and first grade lacking those basic skills that those teachers then have to backtrack and teach in order to get them moving forward, which puts them behind, and then it's just kind of a spiral effect that they're behind, and it keeps moving up. And so I would like to see a stronger push for that in Kentucky.
Great. So I want to ask you about the impact that you think it'll have on your community and your district to see an openly gay person running for office. Has that been done before? You said you were the very first member of that community. Is that for the entire state of Kentucky? And what do you think that will do for residents who are members of that community?
It will be a great thing for them. I have been out talking to people here lately, going to a couple of events, and I've already had some people inspired by the fact that I am openly gay running, and that they never would have thought that someone, a part of this community, would be running for an office like that. It would also help anyone who's not realize that, yes, you may have heard growing up that people of the LGBTQIA plus community are these sinful monsters, but we're just normal people like everyone else. I have been doing that with teaching students who, when they graduate and eventually find out about me, they're like, oh, you're just a normal person like everyone else. Like, I am. And seeing that representation and seeing someone fighting for everybody, regardless of sexuality or anything, I think will help people understand more about this community.
So are you out with your students, or do you, you mentioned waiting until they had graduated. Is that kind of, is that a policy or is that a choice? What's the story there?
So I do not talk about my relationships with my students, especially in elementary and middle school. If they realize it and they ask me, I'm not going to hide it. I am going to tell them, yes, I have a boyfriend, and I'm not going to, they're high school kids. They're close enough to being adults to understand. But before then, I don't really answer my kids if they ask. I don't promote it. But just because at those levels, I want the kids to think for themselves. And I want them to just to understand that I'm still just a normal person.
Yeah, you want kids to be kids at that level.
Yeah.
And then I've taught high school. I know that high schoolers know everything. There's not a secret from a high schooler. Great. So if listeners want to support or learn more about you, how can they find you? How can they help you?
Yeah, if you want to learn more about my campaign, about where I stand on many of the issues facing our nation, please visit our website at williamcompton.com. And you can also visit my Twitter at Compton4Kentucky2022 and Facebook, which is at Compton4Kentucky2022 as well.
Thanks for listening to Trickle Down Socialism. If you liked what you heard, please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Also, we'd love to hear from you. If you have comments, questions, ideas for future topics that we should cover, please give us a call at 781-343-1813 and leave us a message at 781-343-1813. And remember to subscribe so you know exactly when our next episode drops. See you next time on Trickle Down Socialism.